All right, we're now ready for Griffin against Pierce, 093138. Mr. Schweigert.
Sorry about that, Your Honors.
No problem. Allowed us to catch our breath.
Okay. May it please the Court, Gregory Schweigert on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Henry Griffin, brings this habeas challenge to his state court murder conviction and his death sentence, which was later commuted to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Mr. Griffin raises two claims. First, that his conviction was in violation of NAPU versus Illinois, and second, that his sentence was in violation of Strickland versus Washington. I'll be addressing the NAPU claim, but I am prepared to answer any questions about the Strickland claim.
Well, let me start with a question for you about the NAPU claim and Mr. Moore's false testimony regarding these relocation benefits. This is the kind of claim that's subject to an assessment of whether it's prejudicial or not, right? And Mr. Griffin, I know, didn't sign the confession that he made, but I thought that one of the police officers who heard him confess did verify that he had made this confession. So by the time we have him confessing to this fairly gruesome murder and we have other evidence in the case, how could Mr. Moore's testimony have possibly made a difference?
Well, let me remind the Court that this is not a sufficiency of the evidence test in a NAPU claim. It's whether or not there's any reasonable likelihood that the false testimony could have affected the judgment of the jury.
Right, and I accept that, but I'm imagining this jury sitting there finding out that Mr. Griffin has confessed and other people are saying things, and Mr. Moore now will assume freely admits truthfully, instead of what he did say, that he was getting thousands of dollars from the state to live in hotels and have his girlfriend's teeth fixed or whatever else was happening.
Well, and Moore was essential to this case. There was no physical evidence putting Mr. Griffin at the crime scene. There was no eyewitnesses who put Mr. Griffin at the crime scene.
Other than Mr. Griffin, who, I mean, if we
That's
accept
correct.
The police officers.
And Moore's testimony also corroborated Mr. Griffin's confession that was unsigned. So, the other piece was the phone call. Mr. Moore interprets the phone call that is played to the jury between Mr. Moore and Mr. Griffin. So Mr. Moore is a key part of their case against Mr. Griffin.
Question about this phone call. It's my impression, looking at the record, that maybe at the time of the original trial, this was more or less intelligible, but by the time marches on and it gets before Judge Zagel, it's no longer intelligible?
Well, we're not entirely sure. The fact that it was played to the jury and it wasn't transcribed by the court reporter at the time could indicate that it was unintelligible at the time as well. So we're not entirely clear. But by the time it was played to Judge Zagel, it was unintelligible.
Is it an old videotape?
It's a reel-to-reel tape, is my understanding, and trying to find it even... Pardon me.
What year was this?
The trial was in 1985. The crime occurred in 1984.
So an old reel-to-reel tape could have degenerated between 1985 and 2006 or whenever, 05 when...
It may have, but we don't know.
Everybody else did.
I know the tape. So, but anyway, there is a fair amount of evidence, and so even on the standard that you're urging, which, granted, isn't a sufficiency of the evidence standard, once we filter this through the habeas corpus deference, don't we have to say that overall the state had a strong case against Mr. Griffin and it couldn't have mattered?
Well, let me just point out, there was another case where Mr. Moore came in, and there was a confession, and Mr. Moore came in and said, look, I was being paid by the state to come in here and testify, and there was two confessions, and this is the Franklin Freeman case, and Franklin Freeman went and got off that charge after two confessions that he had made. But now, so I'm not sure exactly whether or not the confession is the end-all, be-all of this. And at the time, Mr. Griffin was a drug addict, and he had been at the station for quite a long time as well.
I did want to ask you a question about the ineffectiveness of counsel, in fact. It does look like a pretty awful performance on the part of counsel, and you've drawn analogies to the Supreme Court's decisions in Wiggins and in Rompilla and Williams and so on. Is it your thought that if he were to prevail on this part, given that the Illinois Supreme Court has made it clear he can't be subject to the death penalty anymore, that he might, on resentencing, get down something closer to 30? I mean, I guess he's already served quite a while, so he's not going to go below 20 years, but...
Yes, the statute says it can get anywhere between 20 to death, and now death is off the table, so 20 to life. But this isn't an automatic life case. I mean, there was not more than one person who was murdered. It wasn't the murder of a police officer or anything like that. So he has the chance to get anywhere from 20 to life.
I want to ask you about the Strickland as well. Your contention is that the ineffectiveness was in the failure to investigate the sentencing defense or sentencing issues. Are you contesting that there was ineffective assistance in the decision to waive jury?
No, not in this appeal, no.
Right. Well, that being the case, then, the sentencing judge looked at all of the stuff that was not investigated and could have and should have been investigated and said, well, this really wouldn't have made much any difference, not just much difference. He says it wouldn't have made any difference in the sentencing. So how could you make the
Well, prejudice? if you take that and go further, then his ineffective assistance claim would forever be you could never challenge it. I mean,
If it has no effect, what difference does that make? It has no effect in the outcome of the proceedings.
Yes, but every court that takes the ineffectiveness claim has to reweigh it themselves. And that's what Raygoza says. You have to take a fresh look. You can't just rely on the trial judge's understanding of or how he reweighs it. It has to be a fresh reweighing in each instance.
By viewing the record or by...
By looking at the proffered mitigation and reweighing it against the aggravation and what was presented at the sentencing hearing.
So the reviewing the trial to Earl Strayhorn's decision is what he has to do?
Yes, everybody has to.
I thought everybody had been doing that all along.
Reviewing his decision, yeah, and then they've been rubber stamping it. Rather
what do you
than
mean, it didn't come out the way you want it to. It doesn't mean
well, and we'll look at each of the. Okay, the first court to look at it was the Illinois Supreme Court, right. And they said that it was a strategic decision. They were the first ones to really address it. They were the first ones to actually add some analysis to the question of Strickland. And what they did was they said it was strategic. They said that the evidence was cumulative. They said that the evidence was not inherently mitigating. And then they said, well, and then also Judge Strayhorn looked at it and it didn't matter. But all of that, then Judge Zagel looks at it and he says it is cumulative.
He wrote a rather extensive opinion on the subject, too.
I'm sorry?
He wrote a very extensive opinion on the subject.
He did.
He gave it complete thought and went through.
He did. And he took out both that it was, he said it was not cumulative, he said it was mitigating. And then he said, but I have to say that this is that the Illinois Supreme Court made a finding of fact and that the AEDPA deference, he was going to defer to the AEDPA deference of the finding of fact that Judge Strayhorn would not have sentenced him.
So I thought that the point here was that one would take into account Judge Strayhorn's later evaluation of what this evidence might have made him think earlier, but that we understood the Supreme Court as saying the test has to be an objective one. It can't just be a subjective, gee, it wouldn't have made any difference to me. But even objectively, what Mr. Griffin did was, I mean, at this point, worth a life sentence. Don't you think Judge Strayhorn could have objectively thought so?
Judge Strayhorn could have objectively thought so, but Judge Strayhorn said that this was a case that he was going to give the death penalty. It seemed as if no matter what, no matter what mitigation evidence was put on.
Do you think he just didn't really reweigh it?
Well, he doesn't. I mean, from the transcript, it doesn't say that he did. The transcript doesn't say that I've looked at both sides and I discount this and I dis. It's not a very addressed issue by Judge Strayhorn.
Mm-hmm. So you think if Judge Strayhorn, I mean, obviously we can't ask him, but you think if Judge Strayhorn had explained this further, it might have taken it out of the pattern that you see from Rompilla or from these other cases where the Supreme Court is criticizing the lack of the kind of mitigating evidence.
That's right. And let me point out that in Rompilla and in Williams and Wiggins, I mean, the state court had weighed in on whether or not there was prejudice. They said that there wasn't, but yet then it
said much the same thing that we have here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. On the other hand, I guess, you know, you do come back to the fact that that we do owe some deference to the state court's evaluation, and we don't ask state judges to write perfect opinions. We look at the outcome.
Right. And how much deference should you give the state court's opinion when it fails to it fails to address how many affidavits were put in? It fails to address it says
it
that
actually says the wrong number, doesn't it?
Yeah, it says 5 or 7, I can't remember, but there was a lot more than that. There was 11. It doesn't touch whether or not Dr. Hilm, the expert's opinion that Mr. Griffin was had mental problems up until that point. And it also talks about how it's how judge or the attorney decision was strategic, and there was no evidentiary hearing on that. And whether or not there's an evidentiary hearing and the facts that come out at the evidentiary hearing weigh on the reasonableness of the state court opinion. And here they refused to have a hearing on whether or not Mr. Howard was ineffective. The district court did, and I see that my time is
This is still going. Your rebuttal time. If you wish to save it, you're free to do so. If you want to talk to us, that's fine, too.
I'm fine.
All right. Hear from you in rebuttal. Ms. Check.
May it please the court. On the NAPU claim, the critical issue here is whether or not there was a deal to pay Daryl Moore for his testimony. And the district court, after hearing the testimony of both Daryl Moore and the prosecutors involved in the case, emphatically decided that there was no deal to pay Moore. Therefore, the monies that were spent for relocation.
But actually what Mr. Swigert has argued is that there certainly was an agreement to pay him, and whether it was put on the page pay for relocation or pay for testimony, it was pretty generous payment for relocation and certainly doesn't make anything look too good. Why does the
times
label
were better in those days?
Yeah, apparently. Why does the label matter so much?
Because when the actual expenditures are examined, it is clear that the money was spent for relocation, that the money was spent to protect Moore, not to pay Moore for his testimony.
Well, maybe that's what the state thought. Moore said he was running a drug business out of some of these places.
And Judge Zagel said there wasn't a single thing that Moore said that could be believed. Moore was lying through his teeth through the entire evidentiary hearing.
Well, maybe Moore was lying through his teeth at the first proceeding, unless he'd had some downward slip by the time he showed up at the post-trial.
At the original trial, everything that Moore said was corroborated. It's corroborated by the petitioner's statement, by Allen's statement, and there was another witness, Sherman Overstreet, who testified to basically the same thing that Moore said, many of the same things that Moore said. Maybe not all the conversations with the petitioner, but the basic scenario. And Overstreet was not allowed to testify against Griffin. But the point is, in terms of the state's attorneys evaluating the authenticity of what Moore said at trial, all of those things went together to show the prosecutors that Moore was telling the truth. I think the jury found, the Illinois Supreme Court found, that at the trial, Moore was telling the truth because what he said was corroborated. at the evidentiary hearing, now this is after he's been convicted, after he's been sitting in jail for a long time, Judge Zagel said Moore was not happy. He was not happy with the state. He said right out loud, I despise the state's attorney's office. He hated the state. He had every motive in the world to try and lash back at the state. So his testimony at the evidentiary hearing was not credible. That doesn't reflect on what he said at the time of the trial.
Well, the bottom line is, what about all these receipts, though? Apparently there's a fair amount of evidence showing that some very substantial payments were made.
Yes, ma'am, that is exactly...
You don't have to rely on Moore for that.
It is exactly correct. Records kept by the state. Judge Zagel said at one of the hearing dates, I don't think I actually made it into the opinion, it's generally not how a bribe is done, made by check, where payment logs are kept.
We had the case, as I'm sure you'll remember, with the gangster disciples or L. Rukins or somebody, where the U.S. Attorney's Office here was entertaining some people pretty lavishly, and there was evidence of that.
Your Honor, I think
just because there's evidence of it doesn't mean that it was great.
I think there are some very material differences between those two cases. That case was United States versus Boyd. In Boyd, potential witnesses were incarcerated. They were actually in jail. The U.S. attorney allowed them free access to the phone so that they could make drug deals while they were still in jail, allowed them free access to use the state's or the U.S. attorney's offices so that they would come, they would have parties at the offices, arranged for them to have sexual partners. Actually, even one of the secretaries was encouraged to have sex with one of the potential witnesses. There can be no question that there was nothing to be gained in terms of protecting the witnesses by any of that behavior. In the case here, it's very different. Here, Moore was the snitch. Gibson, the victim in this case, was killed because he was suspected of being a snitch. As it turns out, he was not the snitch. It was Overstreet. So just a mere suspicion of being an informant, Gibson was killed.
Very unhealthy, yes.
Very unhealthy. So we had every reason, every motivation to believe that we needed to do everything we could to protect Daryl Moore. There's also a difference here in terms of how much money was spent. Before the trial, there was only $8,000 spent. It was for 10 months, August 1 until the trial, which was June 25, 1985. That eight-month period, Moore was housed. He was kept in hotels. He was moved from place to place. He was checkerboarded around. Why? To keep him alive. Moore didn't believe he needed protection. Moore is trying to sell drugs on the side. He thinks he's king of the road. Doesn't change the fact that objectively he was in danger. And we had to do everything in our power to try and keep him alive, keep him away from the long reach of Charles Ashley. After the trial was done, then Moore was to be a key witness in another prosecution where the victim's name was Sorowski and the defendants, among others, were Fluky Stokes. Again, the stakes were even higher now because now the state believed that Moore would really testify and Stokes believed that Moore would really testify. So now there was even more danger, there was even more notorious drug lord, even more reason to move Moore from place to place to place to keep him one step ahead of Stokes. And as it turns out, we did not succeed. On the eve of Stokes' trial, Moore recanted, took back his testimony in this case, said everything he'd said to the grand jury about the Sorowski case was a lie. We did not succeed. We could not keep, even with these efforts, we could not keep Moore away from the long reach of the drug lords who wanted to prevent him from testifying. So I agree there was a lot of money. But our ineptitude in keeping track of the money does not equate to a criminal intent to buy a witness and knowingly present his perjured testimony. There's simply no evidence that that is what happened. The prosecutors...
About the Strickland part of this case, because that actually concerns me, and I see this as applying only to the sentence, because I think even up through the decision to go before the judge, we don't have anything here. But this does look an awful lot like the Supreme Court decisions where the defense attorney's utter failure to look into anything mitigating or to take any steps really deprived the defendant of, undermines one's confidence in the outcome, I think is the way it's phrased. And we have said that it's our understanding that this is an objective test, and you need something a little bit more than the trial judge saying, oh, I don't think this would have made any difference.
Your Honor, I think two things. First, the Illinois Supreme Court, when they made their opinion, did not have the benefit of Howard's testimony. So there had not been a hearing in front of Judge Strayhorn. There was not any statement from Howard that he had not conducted any mitigation at all. We did not have the lengthy testimony that we had here.
Right. Well, now we know that Howard pretty much stands up there and said, I did nothing.
Correct.
And I didn't have any reason for doing nothing. So Judge Zagel, actually the Illinois Supreme Court, but everybody, I think, agrees that the performance side of the Strickland test, from Mr. Griffin's point of view, has been satisfied. We're over on the prejudice side now.
Yes, ma'am.
And I don't see why the chance at a sentence less than a life sentence, I mean, certainly at the time it was even the death penalty, but less than a life sentence isn't, I guess my confidence has potentially been undermined. Why shouldn't someone's confidence be undermined?
Because when you look at the facts of the case, when you look at Griffin's background, I think it's very clear, in Judge Strayhorn's comments, I think it's very clear that there was no other sentence that was going to be imposed at the time. You have to remember that Griffin was not, I mean, yes, he was a contract killer, but it was not a one-time deal. This was how he made his living. He was an assassin. He had made statements to Moore about how he was going to try and kill Allen. He was angry at James Allen, his co-defendant, because Allen had robbed Charles Ashley and had ticked off Ashley. So, Griffin said, without hesitation, so, all right, fine, I'll pop off Allen.
Griffin but some was of these also other people in the Supreme Court's decisions are kind of equally awful. I mean, none of these folks are the greatest, but,
Again, but a repeat contract killer, someone who makes his life as an assassin. And I understand that there are other cases where there are terrible facts involved.
Sure. I mean, your opponent cites some of them in his reply brief. People against Alvarez, an Illinois case. It's a trigger man. It's a contract killing. It's a 60-year sentence. Other people, murder for hire, 55-year.
Again, I think we need to go back to Judge Strayhorn's comments. Judge Strayhorn, whom George Howard...
Are you arguing for a rule that is just absolutely conclusive on us? Shut the door?
It's our position, and I'm aware of your opinions to the contrary, but it's our position that is the most significant factor. There are other factors that we can consider, but I think, yes, Judge Strayhorn's reviewing of the exact evidence presented now and saying at the end of it all, it wouldn't have made any difference. After 25 years on the bench, this is one of five or six of the most horrible cases where death is wanted.
He's reviewing it on paper, though, isn't he? He's not really seeing and hearing the witnesses. He's defending a decision he'd previously made, and he looks at these affidavits and says, well, no, I would have done the same thing. Should we really give that much deference to that kind of a statement?
Yes, because he was the person who was at the trial. He saw.
He didn't hear the mitigation witnesses, though. He's only remembering one half of the story at this point. He sees that he remembers everything from the trial, we'll assume, but he doesn't see anything new.
He knows that at the time of the trial, the pre-sentence investigation was out, showing that there had been some mental health background. I agree the evidence is not as detailed as it is now.
And contradictory in some parts. The pre-sentence report and the subsequently submitted affidavits contradict each other somewhat, don't they?
In one notable respect, where Griffin himself says, that he had a normal childhood, a normal background.
But normal.
Right. Judge Strayhorn, was entitled to rely on that. I mean, if Griffin didn't see this horrifying background as horrifying, then Judge...
And his lawyer hadn't even looked at it, hadn't even considered what background he'd had. He just pulled the woman in who happened to be in the courthouse the same day as his only witness other than the defendant.
Yes, I'm not arguing that his performance was acceptable. But I do believe that there was absolutely no room for a finding of prejudice under Strickland under this. A killer for hire. He was on parole at the time that he committed the offense. He had been on parole for only 2 months at the time he committed this murder. He talked about committing another murder. he was under indictment for the Sierolski murder, and when Moore recanted, that fell apart. But my point is, this is how he made his living. He had another five prior convictions, prior felony convictions. I think when you put all of that together, I think that the Illinois Supreme Court gave a reasonable application of Strickland in finding no prejudice. And so we ask then that you affirm the decision of the lower court denying the writ for habeas corpus.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Swigert?
First, you asked about the tape being unintelligible. There was a claim raised on direct appeal that the tape was unintelligible. And I also want to point out that why Moore's testimony is so important, Ms. Check helped answer it. He was the one who says that Henry Griffin is the assassin. He's the one who knows that Griffin makes his living by doing that. So that helps point out why Mr. Moore's testimony was so important. And in terms of Moore being corroborated, in 1986, Moore first recants and says, I asked for money for a hot dog truck. And he said, they said they weren't going to give it to me in one payment, that they were going to give it to me some money, $3,000, and to Miss Penny Johnson, my girlfriend, some money, $1,600, after the sentence.
Is there any evidence, though, that he actually just gets cash across the table?
Yes.
Because I thought that the state's position was that this was all, you know, direct payments to the Holiday Inn or direct payments to the dentist or whomever.
Right. And this will help show that he gets cash directly. He says that in 86, he says that he gets the cash. He goes to the state's attorney's office the day after or 2 days after Mr. Co-defendant was sentenced, and they have a check for him. They cash the check right there and hand him over money. So that claim goes for 14 years before we get the state's attorney file. The state's attorney's file comes back, and lo and behold, there's the check. It's a check made out for two different checks, one to his girlfriend, one to him. One was for $1,350, one was for $2,000. At the timing, it was the timing that he said. It was right around when Ashley was, co-defendant Ashley was sentenced. They are made to somebody in the relocation unit. There's a note that says Marlene Sadlowski gave cash to Daryl Moore. Daryl Moore signs it. And all of these things are corroborated by what was found in the state's attorney's file 14 years later. So Moore being corroborated, once he recants, there is some of that. And let me also mention that the testimony was also misleading. I mean, the leading question by the prosecutor says, for your testimony today, you will receive relocation after you testify. But in truth, he had been getting relocation for 8 months before that. And so it's an error of omission in that point. And when George Howard tried to ask him where he was living, at the time that he was testifying, the state's attorney objected, and it was sustained. And so he couldn't even try to find out where it was. So I think those are the points I'd like to make, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your assistance to your client. Thank you as well. We will take the case under advisement.